documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
Is still sleeping. They'll be bidding America goodbye.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, insisting that old acquaintances never be forgot, and broadcasting live from FEMA Region 5 in the mosquito-infested, well, they're no longer mosquito-infested, they're frozen swamplands of pure Michigan. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours. Nice to have you with us as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today's the 2nd of January, 2016. And it's good to have you with us once again. I'm glad you folks all made it through the holidays with all the threats and all the dangerous things out there, all the big bad boogeyman trying to get you on every front. Certainly, that's what we would have you to believe, or they would have you to believe, if you listen to the establishment media prior to these holidays. It seems like we can't have a holiday anymore without the establishment media and the authorities, Homeland Security, pushing it down your throat every single step of the way, telling you how dangerous the world has become and how you folks are just one slip, one heartbeat away from certain death. You got one foot on the banana peel and the other down that deep, dark abyss of terrorism. Terrorism. And this is exactly what they are doing to you. It's terrorism. They are the terrorists. Whenever they go on TV and threaten you this way, they're terrorists. That's what they're doing. And today, it's not ISIS in the cave. It's not the camel-riding cave dwellers. It's the people at the State Department that are threatening you. And they're doing it because it's politically expedient for you. They're doing it because we have a sprawling empire around the globe that never abates, that is big enough and large enough to sap you of everything you have, to steal all of your wealth in the name of keeping you safe. Everything is being done in the name of keeping you safe. That's why these politicians on TV and I'll pick on Donald Trump because he's a front runner, but all of them that are promoting the idea that, well, I think I should err on the side of safety. Excuse me. But there are some things more important than safety today. Our freedom is not for sale. Our privacy is not for sale. There are some things that are more important. And you know what? These are things that are worth dying for in the end. I would rather not be safe than to give up my privacy. I would rather not be safe than to give up my freedom. And this is the spirit that founded this country, and this should be the spirit that every single American maintains in their heart today. Never lose sight of that. Never lose sight of what's so important, the founding principles of this country. And these people that are flooding in here, the refugees, they don't know about the founding principles of this country because they were never made to learn them. And increasingly, public school children are never made to learn them. I'm looking at a very interesting article in The Atlantic today. Actually, it was about a week ago. Can the Constitution govern America's sprawling empire? It says the U.S. Supreme Court struggles to stretch a constitution written for 13 coastal states to encompass non-contiguous states, dependent nations, insular areas, and a commonwealth. They say the dawn of this century has marked the rise of the American periphery. To understand what I mean, consider presidential politics. In the last century, American voters preferred their presidents to be firmly rooted in the heartlands. Plains, Georgia, Jimmy Carter, They said how things have changed. This year, one candidate, Ted Cruz, is a Canadian-born son of U.S. citizen mother and then non-citizen father. In 2008, the nation elected the Hawaii-born son of the citizen mother and non-citizen father. Yeah, that's assuming that you can actually believe he was really born here at all. And that's still up for debate and much controversy. The point is, they're saying here that America has a sprawling empire. And can the Constitution, you know, is this Constitution that founded this country, is it adequate to the task of governing America's sprawling empire? Well, let me clue you in, people at the Atlantic. If we were following the Constitution, we wouldn't have a sprawling empire. Because most of what the federal government does today under the Constitution is illegal under the Constitution. So if we were following the Constitution, we wouldn't have a sprawling empire. So yes, the Constitution is designed to keep empires from taking place. The federal government was never meant to do what it's doing. The federal government was supposed to be small. But that's not what we have today. And why? As this new year begins, people need to understand and take inventory of where we are as a nation in terms of our morality. You know, morality has a lot to do with how as a nation is governed. Morality has a lot to do with whether you will have a nation. The Founding Fathers had a lot to say about morality, ladies and gentlemen. You know, here's an example. John Adams, signer of the Declaration of Independence, Bill of Rights, and our nation's second president, in a speech to the military in 1798, he warned his fellow countrymen, stating, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, said, "The only foundation for a useful education in a republic is to be aid in religion. Without this, there can be no virtue, and without virtue, there can be no liberty. And liberty is the object and life of all republican governments. Without religion, I believe that learning does real mischief to the morals and principles of mankind." Now, if you want to see that reality, you want to look at what he's talking about there, just visit a university campus today and see what they're teaching. Real mischief to the morals and principles of mankind, ladies and gentlemen. Noah Webster, the author of the first American speller in the first dictionary, he said, "The Christian religion in its purity is the basis, or rather the source of all genuine freedom in government." He says, "I am persuaded that no civil government of a republican form can exist and be durable in which the principles of that religion have not a controlling influence." Governor Morris, who's also a penman and signer of the Constitution, he says, "For avoiding the extremes of despotism and anarchy, the only ground of hope must be on the morals of the people. I believe that religion is the only solid base of morals, and that morals are the only possible support of free governments. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man toward God. So, this is the key. And if you have morality, if you have God on your side, which leads to morality. And this is why they were talking about religion. Because religion, when you have it, you tend to be moral, unless your religion is immoral. You have a relationship with God, a real relationship with God, you want to treat people right. The reason why people don't treat people right when they claim to have a relationship with God is they don't really have a relationship with God. But this is what our nation needs, ladies and gentlemen, is a return to basics. This is what our nation needs, is a return to morality. People treating people properly. You can't have a country on a solid foundation when people are at each other's throats, when people are backstabbing each other, backbiting against each other, calling each other names. This is exactly what the other side wants, folks. Divide and conquer. This is why they constantly play the race card, because they're constantly trying to divide and conquer. So I guess what I want people to think about as this new year unfolds is how can we reach people and get back to those basics where people are back on a plane of traditional morality. Now, another thing that they're talking about is in the Financial Times just a few days ago. Why globalizers still retain the upper hand. They say debate often boils down to a war between nationalists and globalists. In her recent unsuccessful campaign during France's regional elections, Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Front, argued repeatedly that international politics is increasingly pitting nationals against globalists. Nationalists are being increasingly pitted against globalists, they say. In this respect, the Financial Times says, if few others, Mrs. Le Pen is correct. All over the world, globalization is under challenge from resurgent nationalist forces. Well, why do you think that is, Financial Times? That's because globalism is killing nationhood, which is exactly what globalists want. Folks, it's not conspiracy theory to suggest that the vast majority of the leaders of at least the big countries are looking to destroy those countries. All you have to do is look and see the policies of both the Republicans and the Democrats to the United States of America to see what they're doing. Is flooding your country with foreigners, is that beneficial to your country? Of course not. You'd have to be an utter, complete moron to think that it is. So are they setting out to destroy the country? Of course they are. Because they're globalists. This is what they want. So, yeah, there's going to be kickback. There's going to be pushback. Why wouldn't there be? Anybody that is a globalist has no business wrapping themselves in the flag of any country. And I hate to say it, but I don't think any of these candidates for presidency are nationalists. They go on, they say, one of the great political challenges of the coming year will be to defend the benefits of globalization. Oh, really? Well, that would be a challenge, wouldn't it? Because there aren't any. They say, while fending off the arguments of nationalists such as Mrs. Le Pen, Donald Trump in the U.S., and his new admirer, President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Well, I don't think Donald Trump is really a nationalist. That's just my opinion. He's certainly not a freedom-loving American, because he's all in on the Patriot Act. He's all in on eminent domain. And Putin of Russia? Are you kidding me?
He's done more for his country of late, but he's still playing the New World Order game, folks. He still goes to the UN meetings. He still talks about climate change and all that other crap. So, they say the benefits of globalization are both economic and political. In economic terms, they include enhanced... Okay, first of all, let's stop there. The benefits of globalization are both economic and political. I don't see a whole lot of economic benefit to globalization. Since NAFTA was passed, which is a globalization scheme, right? It's a regional body being created designed to break down borders. Where's the economic benefit, folks? Our jobs have disappeared. They've gone south of the border. Where is the economic benefit for the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which led to the World Trade Organization, most favored nation trading status for Communist China? How many times, how many jobs have we lost over there? And now they're getting more and more and more powerful all the time. Building man-made islands, folks. And under the international law of the sea, which, if memory serves me correctly, and forgive me if I'm wrong because I'm doing this from memory, I believe that 12 miles off your coast, it's understood or recognized by quote-unquote international law that 12 miles off your coast is your coast. Well, unless you make a man-made island, then you can have another 12 miles off your coast, can't you? Well, what's to stop them from making man-made islands everywhere and have 12 miles off their coast? Maybe they'll make a man-made island 12 miles off our coast, or 13 or 14 miles off our coast, and then they can have launch rockets, right, and bomb Los Angeles like they threatened to do. You see the problem here? If you want to start dredging and making your own islands anywhere you want to make them, that's pretty convenient, isn't it? You can just claim land all over the world. So, they say the benefits of globalization are both economic and political. I don't see a whole lot of economic benefit, and I certainly don't see any political benefit either. Are we becoming more free the more globalization we do? No, I hear more and more threats. And I hear things like, we need to balance your liberty, which means take it away, to keep you safe. So I don't see a whole lot of political benefit either. I don't know how much more of this I can stomach. But clearly the Financial Times... an establishment globalist rag, ladies and gentlemen. I'll put the link to that article in the show notes, although it requires a subscription for you to get to, which I do not subscribe. I just happen to be able to print that one out. Anyway, speaking of globalists, the U.S. State Department, they're trying to find a way out of the mess they've created in Syria. Everything was going fine until the Russians started killing their terrorists, and now they're looking for a political solution, trying to get all the parties to meet, but there's just one problem. The Russians keep killing their terrorists. Now, Mark Toner, one of the State Department spokesholes, he was recently asked about this. Let me take this, make sure this sound level is up. Excuse me. Anyway, Mark Toner was recently asked by a reporter about, you know, the Russian role and how they can find a way out of the mess, and leaders... You know, because they're encouraging people to get to lead or to meet and discuss and have conversations. They want the Syrian opposition to meet with Syria and various, you know, they want to have elections over there. As we'll hear in a moment, the United Nations just passed a resolution. So all of this is going on. And Mark Toner was asked about this, you know, which led to what I thought was a remarkable admission. First, you'll hear the reporter posing the question, and then Mark Toner stumbling around trying to find the answer.
And then over to you, Mike.
Yeah. You're the leader of a militant group that has, as you pointed out, supported a political process, fought ISIL, and taken part in the Riyadh talks, which are explicitly designed to bring about a dialogue between opposition groups and rebel forces that are willing to do so and that you approve of, and the Syrian government. And then somebody, whether it's the Syrian government, the Russians, or somebody else, then kills the leader of one of these groups. Why should anybody in any of those groups think it's a worthwhile endeavor to engage in such a process? Why shouldn't they just fight it out on the ground?
Well, first of all, I think we would agree that it doesn't send the most constructive message to carry out a strike like that.
Because it keeps killing our terrorists.
Complicates those efforts.
It's not constructive when it kills our terrorists.
It is our hope that these strikes don't reverse any progress that we've made.
Yeah, because we've worked really hard to build up those terrorists.
And we'll certainly continue to encourage the opposition to fully participate in this process. We support Stefan Di Mistura's timetable. And I think he has a target date of January 25th to begin the political process. So my answer to you is I hope it does not. We would hope it does not discourage these people from participating in the process, because we need to begin efforts right away to reach an agreement that leads to a genuine political transition. And just as an addendum to that, I would say...
Okay, now listen to this, folks. I want you to listen very carefully to what he says here in this next 30 seconds. Because this, to me, was a pretty amazing... Coming from the State Department, the actual spokesperson for the State Department, an incredible admission.
That this has been a brutal fight over the past now almost 5 years... that has not brought any kind of peace or stability or resolution or way forward. So I think everyone recognizes, certainly those who are immersed in this fight, would recognize that there's no military solution to this conflict. Does that involve taking risks? Certainly.
Okay, all right, that's enough of that. He said this war hasn't brought any kind of peace or stability, resolution, or any way forward. In other words, he's saying our policies have failed. We in the Obama administration, State Department, and Pentagon are all a bunch of complete and abject failures. That's what he's saying here. He's further pressed by the reporter on the stability of the Assad regime, who the administration has desperately been trying to oust.
Reuters reported today, based on a number of several U.S. officials, that 3 months into the campaign, Russia's involvement has helped stabilize Assad, has made him has put him in a position safer than he was 3 months ago. Is that what you're seeing? Do you feel that Assad has been more stabilized by Russian involvement?
Sure. Michael, you know, I'm always wary of... affirming or disputing, anonymous or unnamed sources from the U.S. government. I don't know who those people are. I don't know what their assessments are.
Because they might actually tell the truth.
You know, I wouldn't say anything differently than we said a week or a month ago, which is that, Russia has, by its actions, put itself in a very precarious place in terms of supporting a government that has brutalized its own people, its own citizens, that represents a minority
Yeah, well, we've dealt with the allegations that they're brutalizing people over there. You know, in the meantime, we're in bed, the United States government is, I should say, with Saudi Arabia, who's just killing people, beheading people left and right. But hey, that's fine. That's, you know, persecuting Christians. Hey, that's fine. That's no problem. They're our guys. But no. You know, Saudi Arabia or Syria, Assad. He's got to go. He's evil. He's killing people. He's gassing people. You know, it's the same argument they used against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, all over again, the same type of nonsense.
The population, and we would hope, and certainly it's something we've been working, and in some respects working constructively with Russia, to put in place a political process that can address that core issue so that we can all turn our attention to fighting ISIL, and so that we can bring some measure of stability and peace back to Syria.
But from your vantage point, do you see signs that there's more stability there, that he's stronger, the Syrian government over the past, as you know, opposed to three months ago?
I think that, you know, I mean, look, Russia has Russia's presence, and we've been very clear about this. Do we believe Russia can play a constructive role in Syria? Yes. Do we believe that it's operations or strikes up till now have done that? It's arguable that it has done that, and we've said that because it's been hitting some of these Syrian opposition groups that have been fighting Assad.
It's arguable that it has done that. I think what he meant to say, it's arguable that it hasn't done that, but okay.
It's been carrying out strikes against these moderate Syrian opposition. It may well be hitting ISIL targets. That may be the case. But
that may be the case. It's hitting all of the terrorists. That may be the case.
Very complex environment. And what we need, as we've talked about a lot here, is, you know, we need a two-pronged effort. One is to bring a political resolution to the conflict between Assad's regime and the moderate Syrian opposition. And then the other is to address ISIL and its actions in pursuit of territory and territorial gains in Syria.
Folks, it's not that difficult at all. It's not that complex of a problem, Mr. Toner. Just quit offering material support to terrorists and let the Russians take care of the problem. You know, soon the problem will just go away. You know, it's not often, ladies and gentlemen, that you can just ignore a problem. But when you're fanning the flames and pouring gas on a fire just to keep it lit while others are trying to genuinely extinguish it, all you have to do is quit fueling the fire. It's not that complicated at all. Now, we'll continue this when we come back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. And you're welcome to call in if you want. 1-844-6-468-376. That's 1-844-6-468-376. That's 1-844-6-GOVERN. That's 844-6-GOVERN. I had a little difficulty with the chat room this morning, so I don't know if people can get in there or not. But this is Govern America. We're going to take a quick time out. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's www.governamerica.com. My email address is radio@governamerica.com. And I think the chat room is working now. chat.governamerica.com. If you'd like to join in, the folks are in there already. chat.governamerica.com if you'd like to join in, and the phone number if you'd like to call in is 1-844-6-468-376. That's 1-844-6-GOVERN. As we continue on here, we've been talking about the State Department press briefing that was held just recently, as they're held all the time, and they're trying to find a peaceful way out of Syria, you know, saving face, even though they caused the mess. They're, you know, cleaning up the mess, ladies and gentlemen, is never easy as making one. You know, it's like spilling stuff all over the room. It takes just a moment to do that, but it's mopping it all up takes a lot longer. And that's exactly what we're dealing with in war zones, and that's why it's always best to never get into a war. You know, and what's amazing to me is how, you know, the Democrats and the supporters of Obama like to beat up on Bush, and deservedly so, because he got us into Afghanistan, got us into Iraq, all on the false premise that we need to fight those terrorists over there so they don't strike us here at home. Well, you know, it's funny how, if we're to believe the official story on San Bernardino, well, that strategy ain't working, is it? Because they struck us here at home. So, what good is it fighting these wars? What good is it? Are we losing the war on terror? Well, when you consider the scumbags at the State Department and the federal government are the ones creating the terror, then yeah. And that's the thing, folks. That's what people have to get through their head today. All of this stuff is nonsense. This is all a false argument. People need to realize where this stuff is all coming from. Now, getting back to this press briefing, Mark Toner, he goes on to demonstrate the extreme arrogance that the sleaze in Washington, D.C. is renowned for. Now, folks, when you listen to this next clip, you need to keep telling yourself that this is the reason why, this is the reason why America is hated by the rest of the world. It has nothing to do with hating us for our freedom. Oh, they don't like us because of our freedom. They want to kill us because of our freedom. Bullcrap. It's all about extreme, pompous, arrogant, smug notions that we have somehow have the right. Our destiny is to be up in everybody's business.
Yes, when you refer to us and you say, he represents a minority, you're not suggesting that that minority ought not be represented, are you?
No, certainly not. I'm just saying, I apologize, but what we said, and the secretary has... No, I'm saying that we need an inclusive...
Right.
What he has, and others have spoken about this as well, is that... you know, the preponderance of his actions, brutality, whatever you call it, against his own citizens have been...
I understand fully, but you know, you have many minorities that actually look to us.
Of course, and we've been
presenting many.
Of course, and we have been very clear. You know, well, right. Wait a second. So I want to be very clear that we don't believe that President Assad is a legitimate leader.
Okay, did you hear that? We don't believe. We at the State Department, we, in our infinite wisdom, we don't believe that Assad is a legitimate leader. Well, isn't that for the people of Syria to decide, you little scumbag?
Or the kind of Syria that we support?
That we support. We don't think it's the kind of Syria that we support.
Russia says it supports, that the other members of the SSG support, and that other Syrians say they support, which is...
Other Syrians say they support. Well, gee, what Syrians might that be, Mr. Toner?
Sovereign.
Sovereign? Did you use the word sovereign? Are you kidding me?
Country.
Folks, this has nothing to do with Syrian sovereignty. The Syrian people had no say in your going in, Mr. Toner. You, at the federal government, and attempting to overthrow their government, what say did they have in that? Do you think that the Syrian refugees who have been freezing to death in foreign countries, dislocated from their homes by terrorists, that you scumbags armed and supported, do you think that they would approve of your meddling into their country's affairs? Sovereignty? Are you kidding me? Do you think their sovereignty was upheld as they were slaughtered by your drones, beheaded by your mercenary terrorist armies? Do you think their sovereignty was upheld... when their ancient artifacts were looted by moderate rebels that you supported? Give me a break. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, Secretary of State John Kerry, oh boy, you know, he's acting as the president of the United Nations Security Council. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened up the meeting by exemplifying, well, again, the complete and utter failure of U.S. and U.N. policies in the Middle East. Now, he didn't put it that way, but that's what it really amounted to.
The Syrian conflict began with the peaceful popular demands for political change, but it soon became defined by internal, regional, and international divisions, including in this very council. Almost 5 years later, we see a country in ruins, millions of people scattered across the world, and the whole wind of radicalism and sectarianism that challenges regional and global security.
Well, sounds like your work here is done, huh? Sectarian violence, destabilization, threats to world peace. Hey, sounds like things are going to plan. This is exactly what the United Nations does.
I therefore welcome the critical initiative of the International Syria Support Group. In particular, I recognize the statesmanship of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And I also welcome the resolution the Security Council will adopt at this meeting. As the first resolution to focus on the political path to resolving the crisis, this marks a very important step on which we must build. Excellencies, at the two recent meetings in Vienna, the ISSG made two major requests of the United Nations. First, to convene in January formal negotiations between the Syrian government and opposition representatives focused on a Syrian-led transition process. Second, and in parallel, to determine the requirements and modalities of nationwide ceasefire. The United Nations stands ready to undertake these important tasks. We welcome the meeting convened in Riyadh that brought together a broad spectrum of the Syrian opposition. As the government and opposition delegations are getting ready, the United Nations stands ready to relaunch intra-Syrian talks mediated by my special envoy, Mr. Stefan de Mistura. As set out in the Geneva Communique, the parties must ensure the full and effective participation of women in these talks. This morning, at a meeting, I urged the ISSG to apply the necessary pressure on the Syrian parties to immediately implement the following confidence-building measures. First, stop the use of indiscriminate weapons against the civilians, including barrel bombs, which have continued despite the government's pledge to refrain from such assault. Second, allow unconditional and unimpeded access for aid convoys. Tens of thousands of people in besieged areas have been forced to live on grass and weeds. This is outrageous. Third, halt attacks on medical and educational facilities and lift all restrictions on medical and surgical supplies from humanitarian convoys. Fourth, release all detainees. Reports indicate that prisoners face a torture.
Okay, first of all here, folks, what he's saying here is lay down and surrender while you're at war with the terrorists that our government is funding. Just lay down and let the supplies come through. Don't bother defending yourself. Is this really realistic if your country's under attack, ladies and gentlemen? I don't think so.
And atrocious conditions. Mr. President, distinguished council members, nearly 2 years have passed since the Geneva II conference. The people of Syria have suffered enough.
All right, that's enough of this, nonsense. Unbelievable. Ban Ki-moon, closet communist? Aren't these all these people closet communists? Ladies and gentlemen, the whole UN system is set up for global communism. And that's the bottom line. Now, he mentioned in that clip, by the way, it's worth bearing out, worth pointing out, that none of these horrendous conditions that he describes here would have ever been happening, nor would the need to engage in these talks be necessary, had the U.S. not started this war in the first place. So, but he mentioned the IISG, which is the International Syrian Support Group. Now, we've talked about, and this is not to be confused with the SSGs, the Syrian Support Group, a group we've talked about here before. The Syrian Support Group, reading from Wikipedia, they were a Washington, D.C. non-governmental organization that was founded in December 2011 in response to the actions of the Syrian government in the Syrian Civil War. Okay, again, State Department-sponsored Syrian civil war, folks. The group shut down its operations in August 2014. The Syrian Support Group was the only organization. Now listen to this. The Syrian Support Group was the only organization legally permitted by the United States government to provide support directly to the Free Syrian Army. So this was a licensed group by the State Department to funnel the money and supplies and everything to the Free Syrian Army. The Syrian Support Group provided non-lethal, they claim, aid to units of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, which it determined had no affiliation with extremist groups such as the Al-Nusra Front. Yeah, right. So this was the channel through which the State Department was funneling resources, the Syrian Support Group. And by the way, the Free Syrian Army, do you think that they would have had the guts to rebel against Assad were it not for the backing of the United States government? I highly doubt it. So that's what this is all about, folks. Anyway, very important. And understand, back in 2012, New York Times, Al-Qaeda taking a deadly new role in Syria's conflict. I believe this was about the time, if I remember correctly, that ISIS was starting to materialize, or just before we heard the word. I said it is the sort of image that has become a staple of the Syrian revolution. A video of masked men calling themselves the Free Syrian Army, and brandishing AK-47s with one unsettling difference. In the background hang two flags of Al-Qaeda, white Arabic writing on a black field. Sounds like the ISIS flag, doesn't it? We are now forming suicide cells to make jihad in the name of God, said a speaker in the video using the classical Arabic favored by Al-Qaeda. The video posted on YouTube is one more bit of evidence that Al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremists are doing their best to hijack the Syrian revolution, with a growing, although still limited, success that has American intelligence officials publicly concerned and Iraqi officials next door openly alarmed. So, I'm not going to read any more of that. It'll be in the show notes. The point is, all of this came from the State Department. Every bit of it. Here we have from the New York Times again, November 8, 2012. Missteps by rebels erode their support among Syrians. Dateline Beirut. Syria's rebel fighters, who have long staked claim to the moral high ground for battling dictatorship, are losing crucial support from a public increasingly disgusted by the actions of some rebels, including poorly planned missions, senseless destruction, criminal behavior, and the cold-blooded killing of prisoners. These are the people your government backed, and they have the audacity to listen in on your phone calls calling you a potential terrorist. Well, here's a news flash for you, federal family. You people are not potential terrorists. You are terrorists. And why would they want to listen in on us, ladies and gentlemen? Because tyrants always fear those they rule over. That's the bottom line. Now, I said you need to not confuse the two groups. The Syrian Support Group officially ended. There is now the International Syria Support Group. Wow, these people really aren't very imaginative with their names, are they? November 14th put out a statement which appears on the State Department website. meeting in Vienna on November 14, 2015 as the International Syrian Support Group, the Arab League, China, Egypt, the EU, France, Germany, Iran, Iraq, Italy, Jordan, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, the United Nations, and the United States discuss how to accelerate an end to the Syrian conflict. The participants began with a moment of silence for the victims of the heinous terrorist attacks of November 13th in Paris, false flag, and the recent attacks of Beirut, Iraq, and others. The members unanimously condemned in the strongest terms these brutal attacks against innocent civilians and stood with the people of France. Anyway, it goes on, but this is the International Syria Support Group made up of these countries and the UN. So we have this Security Council resolution that was passed. And of course Ban Ki-moon was talking about this. John Kerry was talking about this. The Security Council, according to the UN's website, endorsed a roadmap for peace. For a peace process in Syria, setting out an early January timetable for the United Nations facilitated talks between the government and opposition members, as well as the outlines of a nationwide ceasefire to begin as soon as the parties concerned had taken initial steps towards a political transition. This is the international community, ladies and gentlemen, trying to save face. They're going to try to continue to get rid of Assad in a political way. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, I don't think any of this ceasefire or the push toward a ceasefire would be taking place had not Putin got involved and started bombing the State Department's terrorists. So, I do know that with the New World Order, there are competing interests. With the United Nations, with the various aspects of the global order, there's infighting that takes place, there's jockeying for position that takes place, and I think this is a result of that. He got involved, messed up their plans big time. They say unanimously adopting Resolution 2254 of 2015, foreign ministers and others gathered in New York for the third meeting of the International Syria Support Group, which I just referred to. The Council reconfirmed its endorsement of the 30th June 2012 Geneva Communique and endorsed the Vienna statements in pursuit of the communique's implementation as a basis for a Syrian-led, Syrian-owned political transition to end the conflict. I don't think anything here is led by Syria, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, they... Scrolling down here on this page, and I will put this resolution in the show notes, if you are inclined to read it. It's written in the usual UN language, which makes it very, very boring. Most of what the UN writes is boring. All written in legalese. But this is a resolution, 2254 of 2015. And they say... recalling its resolutions, and they list a whole bunch of resolutions, reaffirming its strong commitment to the sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic, and to the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations, expressing its gravest concern at the continued suffering of the Syrian people, like they give a rip, the dire and deteriorating humanitarian situation, the ongoing conflict, and its persistent and brutal violence, the negative impact of terrorism and violent extremist ideology in support of terrorism, the destabilizing effect of the crisis on the region and beyond, including the result of increase in terrorists drawn to the fighting in Syria, the physical destruction in the country, and increasing sectarianism, and underscoring the situation will continue to deteriorate in the absence of a political solution. Blah, 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 blah. One thing these people can do is blab. So they say, bearing in mind the goal to bring together the broadest possible spectrum of the opposition chosen by Syrians who will decide their negotiation representatives, hogwash. That's utter complete bullcrap. But that's what they say. They'll decide their negotiation representatives and define their negotiation positions so as to enable the political process to begin, taking note of the meetings in Moscow and Cairo and other initiatives to this end, and noting in particular the usefulness of the meeting in Riyadh on 9 to 11 December 2015, whose outcomes contribute to the preparation of negotiations under UN auspices on a political settlement of the conflict in accordance with the Geneva Communique and the Vienna Statements, and looking forward to the Secretary General's Special Envoy for Syria finalizing efforts to this end. We reconfirm our commitment to the Geneva Communique. We request the Secretary General, through its good offices and the efforts of this Special Envoy for Syria, to convene representatives of the Syrian government and the opposition to engage in formal negotiations on a political transition process on an urgent basis, with a target of early January 2016 for the initiation of talks, pursuant to the Geneva Communique, consistent with the 14 December 2015 ISSG statement, with a view to a lasting political statement of the crisis. Anyway, it goes on from there. I don't have time to read the whole thing here on the show, but I'll put it in the show notes, this big long page with information about it and the resolution itself at the bottom. Is there going to ever be peace as long as you have psychopaths running the world? That's really the question, ladies and gentlemen, that everybody needs to ask. How long will the world tolerate psychopaths running things? There is an organization which sounds an awful lot to me like PNAC. You remember PNAC, the Project for a New American Century. They're the ones that planned the war on terror in advance, published in the Rebuilding America Defenses document a full year before 9/11, the triggering event that would kickstart the war. They were the ones that published the blueprint for the war. And it was made up of Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the other neocon suspects. Jeb Bush, as I recall, was in it. Another reason why he needs to be nowhere near the White House. He really needs to be near the inside of a cell. That's what he really should be. Anyway, but PNAC went away. Now there's the Center for a New American Security, which sounds an awful lot like PNAC. And it's pushed by a whole lot of people who have a whole lot of profiteering in the war going on. We'll talk about that some in the next hour. Believe it or not, we're already at the end of this first hour. Time's going by very quickly. So stay with us. This is Govern America. By the way, you're welcome to call in. 1-844-6-468-376. 1-844-6-GOVERN. Or 1-646-8-GOVERN. And govern is 468-376. Hour number two of Govern America straight ahead. Please, please stay with us. We're back. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. Greetings to all the folks in the chat room. Greetings to all the folks on American Voice Radio Network. Glad to have you along in all the various streams, micro stations that carry the broadcast, Thank you for the work that you do. We appreciate you reaching people on the ground where it really matters. Moving along here, I'll get to the Center for a New American Century, or Center for a New American Security, here in just a moment. But first, we have a caller on the line, and let's go ahead and take the caller. John, I think, in Tennessee, I think it's...
It is. You know, Darren, I'm listening to this. What came to mind was a book that I read. I was about 10 or 11 years old. My sister was in college, brought a book home by Marshall. I think his name was Marshall McLuhan. The medium is the message, or the medium is the massage. I don't have it with me, but it's basically advertising and propaganda. And over the period of time of the last 100 or so years, they have been eating the elephant one bite at a time, to the point where they have, I think, with the help of Hollywood, have written a script of how to cause this to happen. Kind of problem, reaction, solution, using the dialectic, using it in the media, using it in the movies, using it in the news to cause people to believe in something that we've all heard of, this augmented reality that for the most part we think of it as a multiplayer computer game, but they are basically augmenting our reality. The reality that we're looking at day by day, the reality that we're living day by day, is being manipulated and presented as something other than it is, and we're believing it.
Yeah, we're seeing that with the active shooter drills, with the crisis actors being hired and brought in.
That's part of the technique of augmented reality, mm-hmm. is to use actors. And to use manipulation, and to, now it's almost like the holodeck on Star Trek, where you go in with these glasses on, except they've tweaked our brains to the point where most people don't need the glasses. Just give me the information. The imagination is an amazing thing, and we can see a lie as truth, and truth as lies, just like the Bible talks about. They'd rather have the lie than the truth. They've exchange truth for a lie. They're causing evil good and good evil, and we're living it to the point where, with these crisis actors, that they're actually using words like you mentioned PNAC, Brownback, and the others, and they're using terms, and they're using techniques that are just, they're flipping the truth on its ear. I kind of had a little bit of a brain skip here, but it's really ingenious evil. It really is a mastermind of evil that are causing people to believe something that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm making much sense.
No, you're making good sense to me. It's very obvious that this is the fictional... nature of, it almost sounds odd to say it this way, but the fictional nature of reality. It's very...
Well, that's their intent.
It's an interesting paradigm, isn't it?
Well, it is, because it's psychological warfare to the nth degree. You know, it's multiplicity. It's... they control the media. They control the government. We hear words from them like, and I've heard it time and again, America's branding problem. These are advertising terms, folks.
Yep.
They're talking about we've got to have a new brand. They're talking about...
Well, what they say is we got an effective brand. We got a powerful brand.
Right. And then what do they call people that are involved in it? Well, they're stakeholders, shareholders, participants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and look who's running this place. You've got people that, they're people from corporations, and we say, well, we need them. They've got business experience. We need them to run the country. Well, look, Darren, I'm not a wealthy man, and I'm not real smart, but I think I would know that when I got more than $1 trillion into debt, that I needed to cease spending, because for you or I or anyone else, to be as in debt, as, you know, proportionally to what the government is, we would not be under the jail. We'd be swinging from a gallows somewhere for grand theft, you know, a thousand times over. When you're enslaving your posterity and you're literally selling your posterity's birthright, their future, on their on a proposed or pretended or intended capability of producing money that really isn't money, I mean, producing debt, you know, mm-hmm. so that you can go deeper into debt and have the Congress go before the House or the House go before the Congress with folded hands, with a sincere heart, mind, and really meaning what they're saying. If you don't let us increase our spending limit, we won't be able to pay our bills. That would be like you or me, if we had a credit card, going to Bank of America or First National, whatever your bank is, and saying, I need you to increase my spending limit. Well, why yep. do you need that, John? If you don't, I won't be able to pay this month's credit card bill because I'm going to pay you with credit on your card. They'd say, you're nuts. Go away.
Well, you know, I think that there's... It's obvious one of the reasons why this Middle East crisis is going on. I always come back to the Bretton Woods Agreement and the dollarization of the oil. You know, the attachment of the dollar to the oil, you know, what they call the petrodollar. Because, you know, again, this is the reason, you know, people make the mistake of saying, well, we're fighting all of these wars for oil. Well, that's only part of the issue. It really isn't about the oil itself as it is about what the oil represents and what's attached to the oil. You know, if they ever allow the currency, you know, it's the biggest Ponzi scheme in the world. And with Ponzi schemes, you always have to keep the money moving. If they ever quit using the dollar to transact their oil, the whole system collapses. And this is why. I mean, they're trying to prop it up for as long as they can until they get the replacement in place, and then they're going to have, I don't know, maybe a smooth transition, but I doubt it. You know, I think
that's part of the problem. Part of the problem, Darren, is that we've been mediafied. If that's even a term but we've been mediafied to believe that the people in the Middle East, because of their ability to live in, you know, in a clay hut with a dirt floor, we've been taught that they're stupid. When really they know what money is, they know what enslavement is, they know that a centralized bank with an economy built on debt is not something that they want to do. So as a result, they are attempting, through warfare, through imperialism, as a corporate police force or a corporate hired mob, going in and making war to force these people to enter into the pyramid scheme that they don't want to do. Because it's like you said, when the supply of people coming in ends, the scheme collapses. It has to, because there's no one to keep it going.
Yep.
So now what are they doing? Who are our enemies? Those that are involved, not involved in central banks, those that are on systems with real money. So,
yep.
You know, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, it is what it boils down to, and this is why they call them terrorists, because they are terrorists to their system that they've erected. That's why they're a threat to the system. You know, and
Isn't it funny, Darren, that the book of instructions before leaving Earth says, for we know that the rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant or slave to the lender. Isn't that amazing that the love of money is the root of all evil? How many people have died? Innocent men, women, children, even those that aren't really innocent, but they may be weak-minded to the point of believing that they're going to battle to support and defend this great country that really isn't all it's cracked up to be. The nation is. I love the country. But my government is messed up, just like every government around the world. And what's really upsetting to them is when people come out from their slumber and their stupor and their hypnotism and they begin speaking out, well, then you're a potential domestic terrorist. The truth cannot be tolerated in the land of free speech.
Indeed. Well, I think of, you mentioned scripture, right? The scripture that comes to my mind when I think of all these military men and women being dispatched around the world willingly being led to the slaughter. The thing that comes to my mind is the passage, I think it's in Hosea, "My people perish for a lack of knowledge." This is the problem.
Another one that matches that perfectly, and it's in Samuel. When the people of Israel went to Samuel and said they didn't want a judge, they wanted a king. And God told Samuel, give them a king, but tell them what they're going to do. Your sons will run before the king's chariot. Your daughters will work in his confectionaries. And what do we see? Our sons running before tanks throughout history, through before chariots, before horses, in World War I and the Civil War. And what are our women doing? They've gone to work. And we're reaping, because we call this king a president, we're reaping God's judgment. And I don't want to take you off track, but I'll be listening. I just wish people could wake up.
Yeah, me too.
Steve.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Darren.
All right,
bye.
Talk to you later. Bye. There he is, John in Tennessee, ladies and gentlemen. Earlier I was talking about the Center for a New American Security, and this really dovetails, you know, John mentioned that the corporations are running things. Well, this think tank, Center for a New American Century, the CNAS, remember the PNAC? Well, this is the CNAS. Center for a New American Security is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank established in 2007 by co-founders Michel Flournoy and Kirk Campbell, which specializes in U.S. national security issues. Now, folks, they tell us we live in a quote-unquote democracy, which is bullcrap, because our Constitution says that we have a Republican form of government. But, okay, well, even if you accept that you live in a democracy, that means that the vast majority of the people should be, should have a say and what the policy is going to be. So then why do we have the Center for a New American Security and think tanks like them determining what our public policy is going to be? They say the CNAS, their stated mission is to develop strong, pragmatic, and principled national security and defense policies that promote and protect American interests and values. Well, you know, that's funny, because I don't think my American interest and value is being protected. Not when wars are being started, not when wars are being fought in my name, not when enemies are being created in my name, not when sons and daughters are off fighting and dying under false pretenses and lies. How's that in my American interest and value? CNAS focuses on terrorism and irregular warfare. Irregular warfare. Let me write that one down. Irregular warfare. Interesting terminology. What do they mean by that? The future of the U.S. military, the emergence of Asia as a global power center, and why is Asia emerging? Because we've empowered Asia to emerge. That's why, through the WTO. And the national security implications of natural resource consumption. And there you have it. Natural resource consumption, ladies and gentlemen. And that's what it's all about. Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg has called CNAS an indisputable feature on the Washington landscape. Speaking of, at the CNAS annual conference in June of 2009, U.S. Central Command Commander General David Petraeus observed, quote, "The CNAS has in a few years established itself as a true force in think tanks. tank and policy-making circles. And who is General Petraeus? Keep in mind, listeners, the connection with the Kagans. Remember, Frederick Kagan, his wife, Victoria Nuland, the Kagan clan was Kimberly Kagan and her husband were actually telling David Petraeus how to run the war. And they bragged on their website and in their materials that they worked for free. And yet, their organization, Kimberly's organization, is funded by the military-industrial complex. So were they really working for free, folks, or were they doing what they needed to do to execute the war to keep the money coming in for their sponsors? And that's the point. Now, this Center for a New American Century, ladies and gentlemen, if you go to their website, you can see their board of directors. They have a number of different people there. There's a number of different corporations represented there. Apple Incorporated is there. There is the Boeing Company. Gee, don't they make war jets and things like that? I think they do. The Rand Corporation. Something called Endgame. There's also a number of banks involved. I'm just trying to grab Goldman Sachs. Gee, don't they offer financing for war? And, you know, on their directors emeriti, there is Madeleine Albright. And anyway, the real story on this Center for a New American Security, if you go to the page where they talk about their contributors for 2014 to 2015, there's the Boeing Company, Carnegie Corporation of New York, Northrop Grumman, the government of Japan, Bank of America Corporation, Chevron, Lockheed Martin, Morgan Stanley, and Open Society Foundation. Where have I heard that before? Isn't that George Soros' organization? Open Society Foundation? I think it is. Pentagon Federal Credit Union. Raytheon. The Raytheon Company. Yeah, there's no war profiteering going on here, is there? Textron. BP. The oil company. Yeah, nothing to gain here by prolonging wars, huh? Then you got AT&T, BAE Systems, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, Dyncor, Google. These people are all the people that are involved in this Center for a New American Century. Or, I'm sorry, Center for a New American Security. These are the people that are pushing public policy. Goldman Sachs is in here. Royal Dutch Shell is in here. United Way of Metro Dallas. Anyway, it goes on. I mean, the list is long. But I just thought I'd pick out a few names for you to make the point. Why are these corporations allowed to make your public policy, ladies and gentlemen? Why is this being allowed to go on? Anyway, with that as background, let's go to the Center for a New American Security. There is the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Joseph Dunford. He was speaking there recently. He's telling his military-industrial complex-supported think tank how he plans to defeat ISIS.
But I want to make it clear that within the framework of international and domestic law, our policies and our end state, I don't personally feel at all inhibited in terms of making recommendations to the president, and we will continue to do that. And as Michelle mentioned, we just came from a National Security Council meeting this morning. The president and the cabinet were there, but we also had General Austin there as well as General Votel. We provided a campaign update, and again, I've been in the job 2 months, but every meeting we've had on this particular issue has concluded by, okay, what more can we do? What other ideas do you have that you want to put on the table that we can have a discussion? So I can assure you I will be as aggressive as I can be in making those recommendations, and that's certainly what the president has led me to believe he expects, as well as Secretary Carter. Let me shift a little bit to Syria. Without a partner on the ground, Syria obviously has presented the most difficult challenge over the past year. And success in Syria requires working with our Turkish partners to secure the northern border of Syria. That has been a challenge. It requires us supporting vetted Syrian opposition groups that will actually do what I mentioned earlier. They will actually take the fight to ISIL and seize the ground that's currently held by ISIL.
Okay, so he's planning to defeat the Syrian opposition, ISIS, ISIL, IS, Daesh, by funding the very Syrian opposition groups which caused ISIS, ISIL, IS, and Daesh to be created in the first place. That's what he just said here. He doesn't say it that way, quite that way, but that's the same policies that the administration has been employing up till now, ladies and gentlemen, and how's it working? You see, this is only going to prolong the war. Of course, he's telling this to the think tank that's made up of the war profiteers. Do you think these people at the Center for a New American Security want to defeat ISIS, ISIL, IS, Daesh quickly? Why would they? That would cut off their gravy train. So what is the real purpose of this UN Security Council resolution, ladies and gentlemen? Is it just smoke and mirrors? Now, keep in mind that Amnesty International report that was issued just recently dealt with this subject.
When it comes to ISIL's vast weapons stash, research from Amnesty International, latest report out, pins the blame on reckless global arms trading. In fact, this report says that more than 100 different types of arms and ammunition have been used in Iraq and Syria by the terrorists. The majority of Islamic State fighters are equipped with weapons seized from the Iraqi army. The terrorists swept across the country in 2014, gathering up the ammunition left behind by fleeing troops. During the U.S.-led military intervention in Iraq, coalition forces sent weapons in bulk to Iraqi armed forces, despite the lack of discipline and raging corruption in the ranks. Hundreds of thousands of those weapons went missing and are still unaccounted for. So let's focus in on them for a minute. Let's take a look at some of the most advanced weapons in the jihadist arsenal. Well, first off, there's the TOW anti-tank missile system, produced in the U.S. and supplied to the Iraqi army. It was also delivered as well to the so-called moderate opposition in Syria in 2014, and there's more. There's the M4 assault rifle, also produced in America, that was supplied again to the Iraqi army and later found in the hands of radicals, just like the Stinger anti-aircraft missile system. Again, highly technically advanced. It's got an 8-kilometer detection capability. Now, of course, Washington has never denied supplying any of this type of weaponry to the region.
I mean, first of all, we have supplied some of the Syrian forces that are fighting ISIL in northern Syria. We talked about that before.
We talked to the author of the Amnesty International report earlier, Patrick Wilkins. He says that the problem Middle East arms proliferation is deepening.
I think that points to a fundamental problem in the region of porous weapons supplies across the region, proliferation that is deepening and worsening the human rights crisis we're seeing across Syria and Iraq. And what we're calling for is that all supply states must look much more closely and carry out much more rigorous risk assessments in order to secure supplies where necessary and to ensure that those supplies can be managed and are not used to abuse human rights. There are measures that could be put in place, and there are joint initiatives to secure stockpiles, train soldiers, to ensure that there is the risk is mitigated.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know how many times we can keep making the point until people understand it. This whole thing is a sham. I'm almost up to the break already, and we almost have, so there's almost not time to go to the next thing, but we have various weather events taking place. We just had the Paris conference, which we covered a couple of weeks ago on the show. And now, coming out of that, we have all kinds of weather havoc. Isn't that interesting? Now, folks, we've talked a lot of times on this broadcast about weather modification. The Air Force, back years ago, 10 years or more, published Owning the Weather in 2025. Now, how long does it take for them to own the weather? That's my question. Anyway, we're going to take the bottom of the hour break, and we'll continue here on the other side of the break. And then when we come back, we'll try to put it into high gear and cover some more stuff. Welcome to call in, 1-844-6-GOVERN. That's 1-844-6-468-376. 1-844-6-468-376. We'll be back in a moment. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. That's a little space. Talk to me. And if you'd like to talk to me, you can call 1-844-6-468-376. That's 1-844-6-GOVERN. And we're continuing on here. And ladies and gentlemen, we have our global warming heads up.
Polar bears playing, Vermont maple syrup, a glacier-filled Arctic, not a frozen cold Europe, coastlines not eroding, corals not bleaching. These are a few of my favorite things.
Well, I mentioned before the break that we had a situation a couple of weeks ago. We had the Paris conference, and the regional bodies are going to be responsible for volunteering us into the Paris Agreement. We read the specific language, and if you didn't hear that show, I encourage you to go back and listen to it. It's the one with Vicki Davis we did a couple of weeks ago. Very important to understand how this is going to be implemented regulatorily, but also it's a voluntary agreement, which means that your regional economic organizations can volunteer you into it without your... Which I, you know, and here's the thing, folks. We got all these multiple overlapping regional organizations and economic councils, councils of government that permeate the landscape here in the United States. All of this is extra constitutional. None of this should be even being done, but it is being done. And any of these bodies have the ability, as I read this agreement anyway, to volunteer to be a party to the Paris conference. So while they say it's not a binding agreement, it becomes a binding agreement. In the meantime, you've got all of these natural disasters taking place all over the country. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer, a rescue crews assist with the evacuations in the Midwest, flooding. We've got... various odd events taking place with snowstorms. You know, we've had unseasonably, up till recently, unseasonably warm weather in the north. I guess it's due to the El Nino, but they're going to blame it on global warming. And in fact, I was at a business recently, and you know, the guy brought that up. Oh, it's a global warming. And it just goes to show you how people parrot what they hear in the media. They put it together in their mind without any critical thinking whatsoever. We've had mild winters, but in recent years, we've had very brutal winters. And you always have natural disasters. But the question I have is, how much does geoengineering and weather modification technology, what role does it play in all of this? We don't know, do we? The biggest secret on the face of the earth right now is weather modification. After all these years, and I've been screaming about weather modification for years, I and others before me, why is it the still, to this day, like it doesn't even exist? Like the U.S. has just sat on this weapon and it is a weapon. The military defense documents claim it's a weapon, and it can be used as a weapon. We know they flooded the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam. That's well documented. But yet, they can't use weather modification as a weapon here, huh? So we got all these people being flooded out. Snowstorms in the south. Texas, New Mexico, I think Arizona, if I remember. And now we have also people claiming, and we got the Republicans, a big, you know, big part of this. TheHill.com, Republican split on attacking climate science. Republican Party is divided over whether to attack the science of climate change when opposing liberal policies. You see, this is your Republicans not standing firm for your best interest, listeners. Many of the most vocal Republicans say they have significant problems with the scientific consensus that the Earth is warming and that the greenhouse gas emissions from human activity is the main cause. The skeptics include presidential hopefuls Ben Carson and Ted Cruz and Senator James Inhofe and Representative Lamar Smith, both chairmen of committees overseeing environmental issues. But others in the GOP aren't interested in litigating the science. They say it's more important and far easier to show that Democratic climate proposals would be disastrous to the economy and kill jobs. Well, they would. They would. But we can't lose the argument on the science. The other side does not have the science on their side, folks. It's bull crap. And people need to understand that it's not science, it's religion, it's pseudoscience. And there are many, many scientists who have signed an agreement that say we don't support the notion of anthropogenic greenhouse warming. I have to dig that agreement back up. It's up on sweetliberty.org. I know that. You can go there and find it there. But there was a myriad years ago of people, climate scientists, meteorologists, various experts in the field, that said we don't think the science is in that people are causing the Earth to warm. And then we see from the Daily Caller, the UN chief praises America's greatest environmentalist, George W. Bush. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon praised former Republican presidential scumbag George W. Bush for kickstarting efforts to put together a global agreement to fight global warming. That was the beginning of our success, Bond told the Associated Press, referring to Bush's attendance of UN global warming talks in 2007. After refusing to ratify the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, the U.S. changed its policy in 2007 and began seriously talking about entering into a global climate treaty, according to Bond. The UN chief said he was very much grateful to Bush for being open to a treaty to cut greenhouse gas emissions. So, without going on with this, the point is, the Republicans, the Democrats, all the same, listeners. So why would you be concerned about who's going to win the next election? Why would you be concerned about anything on a federal level? You're wasting your time, precious time. Your best chance of getting this country back, or at least stopping the onslaught, is on your local level, your states and your city councils and your counties. That's really the only place you might have a chance of making a difference, and only then if you get enough people. This is about an educational effort, which is why I'm sitting behind this microphone, because to be honest with you, that's the only thing I know to do at this point in time, is to try to wake people up and educate them as to the bull crap that's going on around them. We need people. We need additions. We need to reach people, and that's the only chance that we have. In the meantime, you know, speaking of this global warming nonsense, they're claiming now that global warming is killing all the Christmas trees.
A Hoosier farmer blames a changing climate for killing off a popular type of Christmas tree, and that's why he's dumping Christmas trees and switching to a different crop. RTV6 reporter Norman Cox visited the farmer in Monroe County.
This is a Fraser fir, a very popular Christmas tree species, but obviously not in this color. Greg Fowler's family has been growing Christmas trees in Bloomington for more than 60 years. He says the Fraser fir has been by far his best seller because it has soft needles, strong branches, and a nice smell. But now he can't keep them alive because of heat and drought.
What we're seeing here is where the tree has died from the top and it's coming down. It's still alive on the bottom. But once that they start turning brown, any amount in there, the tree's going to die no matter what.
Fowler says these trees fare better in cooler, wetter climates, but until now he could grow them here. But he says the trees simply don't tolerate the hot and dry conditions that now seem to be the norm in Indiana.
In the last 4 years, it's been dry. There's no humidity for them that you can get any moisture whatsoever. And once it gets above 85 degrees, that's when it really starts taking effect on them.
Fowler's brother-in-law, Gary Carpenter, helps with the business. He says Fraser firs go for $10 a foot. When a 10-foot tree turns brown, that's a $100 loss. And the other species don't produce enough profit to keep them in business.
I'd say it's a part of global warming, sure. Over the last few years, you get virtually very little winter, and it has to be attributed to global warming as far as I'm concerned.
Fowler says he's going to stay in the Christmas tree business for about another 3 years until the hardier but less profitable species that are now growing reach full size and can be sold. But after that, he's switching to pumpkins, which he says survive better in this climate.
It has to be global warming. Why, we've never had a warm day in the middle of winter. We've never had droughts in this country, so certainly people must be causing it. You see how the people are so easily manipulated by mass media, folks? Now, and then we got thehill.com. A changing climate means a changing menu. I say, imagine that you and I are dining at a restaurant for a very special meal, where the choices are wide, the server is welcoming and knowledgeable, and the atmosphere is cozy, a perfect place for a crisp December evening. I order a Manhattan, three cherries, and you select a nice white wine. After a selection of raw oysters, we enjoy simple salads of mixed greens, avocado, cherry tomatoes, and fresh parmesan. The conversation is warming up as we work our way to the main courses. Lobster bisque for me, grilled shrimp, and rice for you. We end with coffee, chocolate mousse. Bon appetit, but let's take a few steps back. Our meal came to us from around the world thanks to a complex and interconnected global food system. It involves picking, packing, cleaning, hauling, and shipping. Unfortunately, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Climate Change, Global Food Security, and the U.S. Food System report, released during the 2015 Paris Climate Conference, listeners, last month, points to a new reality. Now listen to this. All of these dots and their connections in this global system are under an intensifying threat. Now, folks, they're talking about your food. If you won't care about anything else, maybe you should care about your food. Keep in mind what Catherine Bertini, United Nations World Food Program, said. Food is power. We use it to control people, human behavior. Some may call that bribery. We do not apologize. That's what she said. So, getting back to the article, they say climate change is fundamentally altering our menu. Big food is taking notice of these changes, and so should we. They talk about cherry trees, like most fruit trees, require a winter dormancy period, but California's winters are warming, and that critically important window of time will be a much shorter in the coming years. Grapes are fussy about high temperatures, too, and shifts in where they can be grown are on the horizon. Our oysters are threatened according to a new report by the National Wildlife Federation. And since when has the National Wildlife Federation become an authority on anything? But that's what they say. Oyster reefs are on the front lines for damage from global climate change. Warmer oceans will mean more algae, which can make it harder for oysters to reproduce. And a more acidic ocean will create a more challenging environment for young oysters to grow their shells. Even the ingredients in our salad will be affected. It is predicted that in 30 years there will be a 40% decrease in avocados due to rising temperatures in California. And they go on from there talking about coffee, the coffee business changing rapidly due to the ever so slight changes in temperature. This is all propaganda, but they're telling you, ladies and gentlemen, your food is threatened. They say to stay ahead of these changes, we need to help farmers find innovative ways to adapt to the changes with more resilient crops programs. Now, how do you have more resilient crops? GMOs, listeners. Programs that help keep soil healthy, information about how to deal with too much or too little water, and much more. The USDA climate hubs, our research universities, the food industry, and other key players in our global food system need to work together like never before, they claim. Now, this guy who wrote this, his name is Hoffman. He's the executive director of the Cornell Institute for Climate Change and Agriculture, faculty of the Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, listeners. Sustainable development. So how are they going to, well, and hey, never mind. Don't worry, because you'll always have your bugs you can eat. Which brings us to our next heads up.
Yeah. There's no holes in my sweater that moss might have made. We never buy fly paper, never need raid. Come into our kitchen, you won't see a fly. No worms in the garden, I'll tell you why. My brother eats bugs. Oh, grasshoppers, crickets, and slugs. Oh, butterfly wings and other girls' things. My brother eats bugs. When we go fishing, there's one thing I hate. We never catch nothing, cause he eats the bait. When we have a picnic, there's one thing he'll do. If there's any ants, he'll eat them all too. My brother eats bugs. Oh, grasshoppers, crickets, and slugs. Oh, butterfly wings and other gross things. My brother eats bugs. He munches on hornets, but never gets stung. But he won't eat woolly bears, they tickle his tongue. We caught some fireflies one night in the park. He swallowed them all, now he glows in the dark. My brother eats bugs. Oh, grasshoppers, crickets, and slugs. Oh, butterfly wings and other girls' things. My brother eats bugs.
Well, the BBC recently had a piece on their broadcast talking about eating insects and how this could be very, very good for the planet.
Hungry? How about a gourmet burger? Maybe some organic hummus? Or a crusted goat's cheese salad? Hang on. What is that? Yep, it's a locust. And it's supposed to be there. That's because all the dishes you've just seen, even the cookies, were actually made from insects.
Black ants will give a really good savoury flavour to it, but they're quite zesty and zingy because of the acetic acid. So it's a real new kind of, I suppose, flavour here in the West that we're not used to.
For some, the food at the Grub Kitchen in Wales might seem a wacky trend, perhaps one for the bucket list. But what if it actually had the potential to save the planet?
This is a 200-gram steak.
On the same land it would take to produce this amount of meat, you could actually get 2 kilograms of edible insects. As for the amount of feed it would take to produce, you would have 2.5. The greenhouse gases emitted from producing 200 grams of steak is the same as if you were to produce 20 kilograms of edible insects. And that's why Andy's partner Sarah has dedicated her whole life to studying the effects of eating insects on the environment.
And the larvae, these are the protein packages, so these are the ones that we actually eat.
And she thinks far more of us should be.
The others. The difficulty is that, say, by 2050, we're going to need 70% more land to feed a growing population, 120% more water. And we just can't carry on farming the way we are because we just won't be able to feed people. So insects offer a really, really fantastic opportunity to feed this growing population.
But there is potentially a problem. Although, it's not the one you might think.
We haven't eaten insects in our diets here in the UK for quite a long time. So have we lost the ability to break them down and get the goodness from them? And I think that's going to be the big key as to whether we can actually make the use of all the goodness contained in the insects.
Even if our bodies can learn to digest insects again, will our minds get used to it?
I think as soon as people realise that insects are not this squirming, disgusting thing that they see people eating in a jungle, and there can actually be a culinary delight, I think it's going to be a matter of... I personally, my opinion is between 5 and 10 years.
Although for me, it's now or never.
Crunchy.
So, you think that one was bad. This is, folks, this is the thing. More and more we're going to see these pieces from the establishment media propagandizing you about the wonderful benefits of insects. And on that was the BBC, but nothing compares to the National Zoological Gardens, their propaganda video that they put out.
Crispy, fatty, nutritious, and delicious. Insects, they are everywhere and come in all different shapes, sizes, and flavors, like the dung beetle. They love poop. The fresher and warmer, the better. They are also fussy about which kind of herbivore drops the steamy gift. For most dung beetles, not just any poop will do. If it's from the wrong species, no ball rolling will take place and the kids will go hungry. Never mind their smelly daytime jobs, they still receive bragging rights for being one of the strongest creatures in the world. Insects, whether crunchy, creamy, bland, or flavorsome, are found on every continent. They are nature's energy bars, packed with protein goodness. Uh-huh. Termites provide high doses of protein and minerals. What better way for an animal to get their daily dose of vitamin A and C than from a termite nest stuffed with juicy bite-sized snacks? When you compare the nutritional value of insects to beef or even fish, it's pretty clear. Insects are the smarter choice. Around 2 billion people worldwide regularly eat grasshoppers as part of their diet. They are tasty when toasted over a fire or fried in their own juices. In terms of feeding the world's ever-increasing population, it seems many livestock have huge potential. Many cultures consume insects, and surprisingly, these delicacies are fetching higher prices in some countries than any other animal proteins, such as beef.
Yeah, doesn't that just make your mouth water, ladies and gentlemen?
Oh, nobody likes me, everybody hates me, guess I'll eat some bugs.
There you go, your New World Order 21st Century Diet, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we got a caller on the line. Let's go ahead and take the call. Hello, who do we have? Oh, let me turn your pot up.
Yeah, this is Kent from West Virginia.
Hey there, how you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, you were talking about the insects. That just popped into my mind. I like to listen to the Radio España Foreign, you know, the international service. Listen on shortwave.
Mm-hmm.
Listen on the internet. But they really had an excellent, excellent, wonderful service. And about 5 or 6 years ago, they read from the diaries of one of the early Spanish explorers coming into Galveston Bay or somewhere down there, you know, and finding the Indians. And I've written to them and trying to find out. I'd like to read it. Describing the conditions of the Indians, and they said that they were just crawling on the ground, eating bugs and grasshoppers and everything. And I think this rewilding of the world, they want to revert us back to, crawling on the ground, eating bugs. Because, you know, once they come up with the industrialize these insects, and then when the supply runs out, and we can't go to the store and buy the insects, and we've got to crawl on the ground to find the insects.
Well, my question is, do you think that the elites, the establishments, you know, the Bill Gates of the world, do you think they're going to be eating insects?
Not on your life.
Yeah, they're not going to... go ahead.
No, that's just rust. That's, you know, they'll have their own Kobe beef and oysters and stuff like that themselves. You know?
Yeah, absolutely they will. Yeah, so, anyway, go ahead.
That's just a vision that popped into my head, because I've always remembered reading that. I've tried to find out, you know, to find a copy of that. So, yeah, they said that the Indians were just skin and bones and crawling on the ground for bugs and everything. So, that's what they hope for, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, in
it. I don't want to ruin your New Year, so.
Well, you're not going to ruin my New Year. I look at the new year as the same as the old year. You know, it pretty much never changes, does it?
No, it doesn't. All right, well, thanks.
Hey, thanks for calling. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Yeah, and folks, here's the thing. I put the push to get you to an insect diet right in line, ladies and gentlemen, with the war on the ranchers. You know, on the one hand, they're telling us, oh, well, food's becoming scarce because of climate change. And on the other hand, they're doing everything they can to force the food growers out of business. The Bureau of Land Management has a big, huge war going on. Tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and take the top of the hour break. I lost track of time. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website. That's www.governamerica.com. My email address, again, radio@governamerica.com. If you'd like to call in, you're welcome to do so. 1-844-6-468-376. Again, that's toll-free, U.S. and Canada, 1-844-6-GOVERN. If you live outside the United States, you can call 1-646-8-468-376, and the country code is 1. That's 1-646-8-GOVERN, and that's the direct line to our phone bridge. I mentioned before the break we were talking about the situation regarding the food, regarding the push, the propaganda to get people to eat insects, and the war on the ranchers, the war on the West is taking place in a major way. We also talked with Vicki Davis a couple of weeks ago about the Hammond family. And I wanted to call your attention. If you happen to be in the area of Bern, Oregon, there is a protest that's going to be going on today. Here's some information about it. I'll tell you what, I'll let the people who are evidently organizing it. Well, I don't seem to have this clip, so I'll just tell you what it's about. You can actually go to governamerica.com on the main page. It's the top item right now, and it says support the Hammonds March. I believe something to that effect. Bern, Oregon. The information about it. They're calling it "I Stand with the Hammonds and the people of Harney County, support rally and march." They're calling for patriots, a patriot convoy from Bend to Burns, and they're going to meet at the Safeway in Burns. And they the address of the Safeway is 246 West Monroe Street, Burns, Oregon, 97720. They said, we will meet in Bend around 10 a.m. and arrive around 12 p.m. in Burns, January 2nd. So that's Pacific time, by the way. It'll be 9... Actually, yeah, that's Pacific time. So anyway, they're saying bring flags, flowers, banners, and homemade signs. We'll march from Safeway North on past the sheriff's office, head east to downtown Main Street, Broadway. Broadway is, and stop by the Hammonds' home. Drop off flowers in front of their home. For those who want to participate, contact your friends to plan a sign-making event in your respective areas. Well, you almost don't have time to do that now. Sorry for the short notice. But if you're in the area, please show your support. Between now, they say talk to your friends and neighbors about this. Anyway, that's the information. All of that is up on the website at governamerica.com. And we encourage peaceful protesting, ladies and gentlemen. Beware also of agents provocateur anytime you see one of these events. Meanwhile, from KDLT, more ranchers sue the feds over spread of 2013 prescribed burns. Prescribed burn. More northwestern South Dakota ranchers are suing the U.S. Forest Service. You see, they prosecute the Hammonds for setting a fire, doing a controlled burn, and it accidentally got out of control. But the Hammonds put it out. Yet, because it crossed the border over into federal land, now they're eco-terrorists. And they prosecute them as eco-terrorists. Yet the federal government can burn land, hectares and hectares of land, and that's all fine. That's all dandy. Rapid City, South Dakota. More northwestern South Dakota ranchers are suing the U.S. Forest Service for a 2013 prescribed burn that escaped its boundaries and scorched private land. A third lawsuit has been filed in federal court alleging that the U.S. Forest Service committed numerous errors in its preparation and execution of the fire. Two similar lawsuits were filed last week in federal court. The third lawsuit brings to 25 the number of ranchers seeking unspecified damages for the April 3, 2013 blaze. Crews intended to burn about one-third of a square mile of the Dakota Prairie National Grasslands. The burn spread across 17 square miles, including 11 square miles of privately owned land, and it took 17 square miles. Wow. That's a lot of land, man. Including 11 square miles of privately owned land, and it took firefighters 4 days to contain it. Will anybody in the federal government go to jail over this? Is anybody in the federal government going to be prosecuted for eco-terrorism? I wouldn't bet your life on it. Meantime, the Daily Caller, top 11 problems plaguing solar and wind power. Despite President Barack Obama's pocket veto Saturday of attempts to repeal the Clean Power Plan and recent increases in taxpayer support, solar and wind energy are in a tough spot, requiring an estimated $90 trillion, listeners, of investment to meet carbon dioxide reduction goals. And again, why are we doing this? It's all based on false premises, lies, listeners. We're putting coal-fired power plants out of business, ratcheting up the energy rates, just as Obama says your energy, electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket. Well, once energy is very, very rare, it can't help but necessarily skyrocket. Supply and demand. But but that's his plan. His plan, his stated goal. How could anybody have supported this communist scumbag? Anyway, they say the fundamental issues of solar and wind power are numerous. So let's review the top 11. Power storage is incredibly expensive on a large scale. The U.S. power grid is older and has trouble handling solar and wind. Well, that's okay. The smart grid is well on the horizon, listeners. The smart grid is being built. I think the smart grid will probably handle the solar and wind just fine, won't it? It'll also track everything you do and feed the information to the NSA and the fusion centers. Welcome to the brave new world Orwell couldn't even imagine. They say rebuilding the power grid to handle solar and wind is absurdly expensive. Well, that's not stopping them from doing it, though. They'll just pass the expense on to you. Say solar and wind don't provide power at useful times. Solar and wind can't keep the lights on by themselves. The best places for solar and wind are usually far away from consumers. Solar and wind are a very small percent of the power grid despite years of subsidies. And that's the point, ladies and gentlemen. All of these green energy things are a scam, as we've covered so often on this show. The solar and wind low-hanging fruit have already been taken. The locations where solar and wind power make the most economic sense generally already have a solar or wind power system. Since solar and wind power are only effective in a limited number of locations, green power sources are difficult to expand and are simply not practical in some areas. Natural gas, moving on to the next one. Natural gas prices are very low in the United States. Nuclear energy has enormous potential, they say. Encouraging wind and solar creates incentives for massive corruption, you think? Attempts by governments to encourage solar and wind power have created incentives for corruption, even environmentalists acknowledge. The recent Volkswagen scandal illustrates that regulatory attempts to force a specific technology, in this case the adoption of cleaner diesel engines, create incentives that lead to a sophisticated cheating by companies. The main incentive of the regulatory agencies is to make rules while avoiding bad publicity, not to actually solve the problem. And there you have it. Couldn't have said it better myself. Government never solves problems. If they do, they're out of business. The push to encourage green systems has already led to serious corruption, such as Solyndra scandal and a whole host of other companies that took your money and ran with it. We covered that a couple of weeks ago on the show. Such corruption crowds out investment dollars that could be better spent on more workable solutions. Anyway, the details of all that will be in the show notes as well. In the meantime, we see conservation efforts going forward. Protection for yellow-legged frogs being pushed by the Center for Biological Diversity. They filed another notice of intent for taking legal action against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service due to delay in taking decision over protection of the foothill yellow-legged frog. The center had appealed to the federal government to include this species of frog in the Endangered Species Act. Petition was submitted by the center in June 2012 to save the frogs. The government officials found that the facts listed in the appeal are true and started with the status review process. A review regarding the declining numbers of the frogs was submitted at the center in August 2012, thereby indicating that the species need to be safeguarded. Well, why do the species need to be safeguarded, ladies and gentlemen? Where did the frogs come from in the first place? And don't we have species come and go? The problem here is that man thinks in his infinite arrogance he can manage things better than God Almighty. If the frogs can't adapt, then the frogs maybe need to go. And if God wants to bring the frogs back, see, here's the thing about the frogs. You know, it's amazing to me. It never ceases to amaze me. Just because you can't see the frogs don't mean the frogs aren't there. We'll go through a dry spell here in southern Michigan, ladies and gentlemen. And I won't see a frog one anywhere. I can walk through the swamp, what area where the swamp is all dried up. When we go through big dry spells, and you don't see any frogs anywhere. The first big downpour you have, and all of a sudden you've got frogs all over the place, hopping along the roads. You can't help but run them over with your car because they're everywhere. So, are frogs really becoming these yellow legged frogs becoming less numerous, or is this just a temporary setback? Have they gone into dormancy? And this is the problem with all of this. These pseudoscientists with a political agenda pushing this nonsense, and a good majority of it, you can't believe any of it. They say, but see, here's the thing. Out west, when the cattle are grazing, restrictions will be put on them because, well, you might step on the yellow-legged froggy. They say the Fish and Wildlife Service has been delaying the process, and good for the Fish and Wildlife Service. They need to kill the process. But it's going to federal court, more than likely. This species of 1.5 to 3 inch frogs, they claim, dwells in streams with less elevation from the Willamette River Basin in Oregon to the San Gabriel River in Los Angeles County. However, the frogs, which have a lemon-yellow color under their legs, are becoming extinct from several regions of Oregon, Southern California, the California Sierra Nevadas, the Central California coast, and the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, I guess the world just needs to stop, doesn't it? Unbelievable. This is the dictatorship of pseudoscience, ladies and gentlemen. When all of humanity has to kowtow and worry about little species. You know, anyway, moving along, we see from BigCountryHomepage.com from Austin, Texas, little spider leads to big legal fight in Texas. Dateline Austin. Central Texas rancher John Yearwood filed a federal lawsuit against the U.S. government last week in what he described as an effort to keep control of his 35-acre property. Yearwood challenged the constitutionality of federal regulations concerning a tiny cave spider known as the Bone Cave Harvestman, which only exists in Central Texas. The Bone Cave Harvestman is considered an endangered and threatened species under the 1973 United States Endangered Species Act. Now, keep in mind, they claimed also, and this is a side note, that the monarch butterfly was big time in jeopardy. Now, Mexico is claiming the monarch butterfly is quadrupling in number, or could quadruple in number. So, these species come and go. That's the point here. Listeners, we shouldn't worry about it. Let God manage the species. But no. That's not how these characters operate. Yearwood said, quote, "This property has been in the Yearwood family since 1871, and now we're kind of in limbo about what we can do with the land, if anything at all," unquote. He said he lets community organizations and church groups camp on his property and use the land for recreational purposes. However, now that the endangered spider was found residing on a portion of his 35-acre property, Yearwood could be prosecuted by the federal government if the endangered spider is disturbed. If our client, Robert Heineke, director of the Center of American Future at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, he said, if our client did any activity like letting kids camp on his property that disturbs the habitat of these species, he could be facing criminal penalties or civil fines for letting kids camp on his land. Unquote. Heineke, who represents Yearwood in the lawsuit, said his client is faced with a catch-22 dilemma because of broad federal regulations. Either he can go through a very expensive, time-consuming process to try to get an endangered species permit to let the kids camp on his land, or he can run the risk that there might be something done that would disturb the species. Either way, he would be prosecuted. It's like it's having private property taken basically from our family, Yearwood said. The family has paid taxes on this property for 140 years and has used it and been stewards of it for 140 years. For the same 140 years. And now the federal government comes in, and there's a big question on what we can do with our own land, or whether we will be prosecuted if we try to do something with it at all. It is kind of a limbo situation. They note that there are 22,000 species in the United States that are regulated by the Endangered Species Act. 22,000 listeners, and God help you if any of these are on your property. According to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, Texas is home to at least 100 of those species that are considered either endangered or threatened. The U.S. Department of Interior was contacted for comment, but has not yet responded. And keep in mind, you don't even have to have them on your property. All you have to have is an allegation that they might be. We've seen that before. All right, moving along here, because we're running out of the hour. The Sun has been very active lately. We've just had some significant storms, solar storms. We had one powerful one hit during the New Year holiday. And it is always a concern, listeners. As a matter of fact, up on the website at governamerica.com, there is, in the center column, there is a solar monitor. And the reason why we put that there is it pulls the data directly from NOAA. That's the government's own monitoring graphic, I guess, for lack of a better way of saying it. And it lets you know when there's a geomagnetic or electromagnetic storm. Anyway, that is up on the website at governamerica.com. You can click on that and go and see the charts for the KP index and that sort of thing. We've had some significant storms going on. This is a concern for a couple of reasons. It could create, those pretty northern lights that you see, which is always enjoyable, especially in the northern climates. But it also can affect communications, and it certainly can affect the power grid in extreme situations. Now, of course, the government has been, for many years, I mean, it isn't like this isn't something that's well known that could happen. But the government has been asleep at the switch, and they have not hardened our electricity system to the threats of the solar storms or an EMP attack by a, quote, terrorist enemy. Now, I'm very concerned about this, and somebody else that's concerned about it, apparently, is Ted Koppel, the former ABC News anchor, host of Nightline, He's been making the rounds. He's got a new book out. And just listen to a little bit of what he has to say.
When the lights go out, we usually know why.
Hurricane Sandy coming ashore on the East Coast.
Mother Nature is at it again. Most of the time, we manage to get through it. But what if the power went out in a number of states, affecting millions of people for weeks, even months?
As you were researching this, did you personally find yourself getting frightened?
I think frightened is a little bit too strong, but maybe I should have been. Yes, it's frightening. It is frightening enough that my wife and I decided we were going to buy enough freeze-dried food for all of our kids and their kids.
So Ted Koppel is actually buying freeze-dried food, listeners. Here is a guy who is a Council on Foreign Relations member, very establishment, and yet he's become a doomsday prepper.
In his book, Lights Out, veteran journalist Ted Koppel paints a grim picture of a paralyzing power outage in the form of an all-out cyber attack on the nation's electrical grid.
Who are the potential perpetrators here? Who do we have to fear the most? Is it Russia, China, Iran, terrorists, individual actors?
All those. The interesting thing, Chip, is the ones who are most capable are the ones least likely to do it.
There are some experts who say they're already in.
Oh, they are in.
They are in.
There is no question about it.
They're into our grid.
They are already in the grid. I was told that by the former chief scientist of NSA. He stated categorically the Russians are in, the Chinese are in. The Iranians may be on the verge of getting in. And then at the bottom of the capability scale are folks like ISIS, terrorist groups.
The power grid is the system interconnecting North America's supply of electricity. If one area has particularly heavy demand, power from another region can sometimes serve as backup. The downside to all this? If a hacker manages to take down an entire grid, a huge portion of the country, along with parts of Canada, could go down with it. The primary reason? Like so much else these days, the grid relies heavily on the internet.
We have a sort of a joke in our security industry that there's no secure system. The only secure one is unplugged, turned off, and buried under 6 feet of concrete.
Larry Pesci should know. He's a cybersecurity consultant who gets paid to find glitches in business computer networks. In other words, he's a hacker who works for the good guys.
In the last 6 years, you know, of me doing testing full-time, there has never been a customer that we've been to that we have not gotten in.
At 5:28 Tuesday evening, give or take a few seconds, an estimated 30 million people in the northeastern United States were plunged into an eerie blackness.
Wide-scale outages are nothing new. In 1965, a huge blackout in the Northeast left more than 30 million without power for almost 13 hours.
New Yorkers have taken it in stride, have they, as far as you've been able to see?
No, they haven't.
You gotta ask them that.
In 1977, New York City was plunged into darkness again, this time resulting in looting and other crimes.
There have been massive power outages, blackouts.
And in 2003, overgrown trees were partly to blame for a blackout that affected 8 states and part of Canada, some 50 million people. That one lasted up to 4 days in some areas. But our next electric failure could be just a keystroke away.
Just a keystroke away. Folks, we got to take a break. We'll be back. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website, www.governamerica.com. As we head off into the sunset of the show today, we were talking before the break about the situation with the power grid, the threats that they're claiming, and how the next blackout could be just a keystroke away. And why is this a concern? Well, it's always a concern when you're talking about the power grid, because especially in the cities, this would be a very detrimental situation as far as civil unrest is concerned. Undoubtedly, if it lasted for any length of time, many, many people would die. But the problem, in a way, I think it's good that they're talking about it because it needs to be, the awareness needs to be raised. But I also am aware that the media, the establishment media, has a propensity to pre-tell a story. They like to pre-tell things. And my concern is, what do they have planned? Do they have something planned? Here's Ted Koppel on PBS NewsHour.
Now another addition to the NewsHour bookshelf. It's a warning about the vulnerability of the country's power grid, and it comes from Ted Koppel, the veteran newsman and former anchor of ABC's Nightline. I talked with him recently about his new book, Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. Ted Koppel, welcome.
Thank you.
You have written a book about the next big threat. We always talk about cyber threats, about hacking, but you're talking about the electrical grid.
We are accustomed to cyber attacks that result in grand larceny. We are accustomed to cyber attacks that amount to huge vacuuming of intelligence information. What we've never had is a cyber attack that amounts to a weapon of mass destruction. And my point is that if someone succeeds in taking down one of our power grids, and the Russians can do it, and the Chinese can do it, and maybe the Iranians and the North Koreans, it would be devastating.
Of all things for you to write about, what got your interest to start writing about this particular topic?
The funny thing is, Gwen, that for about 3 years now, a number of our top leaders, including the president has twice mentioned it in successive State of the Union addresses, warning, just a little paragraph, but warning that there are those who are trying to get into our infrastructure, especially the power grid. The Secretary of Defense at the time, Leon Panetta, called the threat of a cyber attack on the power grid potentially a cyber Pearl Harbor. That's pretty huge, and nobody was paying any attention to it. And so I wondered, A, are these people just exaggerating for reasons I don't quite understand? And B, if they're not, what is the government doing to prepare for it and to prepare the public for it? And my instinct told me that the answer was going to be not much. Not much is an exaggeration. Nothing is closer to the truth.
You have talked to so many people, including the last four heads of the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense. And did you get a sense, after talking to them, that any one of them knows what to do if this were to happen?
Probably not. Several of them know that the likelihood of it happening is great. When I spoke to Janet Napolitano just after she left as Secretary of Homeland Security, and she'd been on the job for 5 years, I said to her, what do you think the chances are of a cyber attack on the power grid? She said, very, very high, 80 to 90%. It seems to me inevitable that we have to deal with this, but maybe because we don't know what the answer is, we have not even begun to do so.
When you talked to Jay Johnson, who currently runs Homeland Security, he was trying to be more optimistic, currently being in the job, but it didn't sound like that conversation went well.
It did not go well, because on the one hand, he conceded that the likelihood of a cyber attack on the power grid is great. On the other hand, when I said, okay, what's the plan? You're the Secretary of Homeland Security. He sort of dismissed it and said, well, as long as you have a radio with extra batteries. And I said, yeah, but so you have a radio and the power goes out and you turn your radio on. What are you going to tell people? And doesn't it seem a little strange that we're going to defer telling people what the plan is until after the electricity goes out and communication is far more difficult than it needs to be?
So it's easy to see there's not a plan, but what would you say the plan ought to be? Mass evacuations from someplace like Manhattan?
Can't do it. Too many people, no place to put them. The only thing, and I don't want to be in a position of even sounding as though I have the answers, but I spent three chapters of the book dealing with the Mormons. And the reason I focused on the Mormons is that the Mormons, after 200 years of being driven from pillar to post, have learned how to survive in difficult situations. And they are probably about as well prepared as any large group in the country. And so the one thing that the Mormons do that I would recommend to Americans in general to do is to have a 3 to 6 month supply of food and water.
So this is not a corporate responsibility necessarily, or a government responsibility. We're not talking about state actors all the time.
It may be. I mean, it may be their responsibility, but since what I'm finding is that they haven't taken that responsibility very seriously, or at least have not come up with a solution yet, I'm saying to those people who can afford it, and I fully appreciate that there are tens of millions of people in this country who can barely afford to put food on the table every day, let alone get a supply of 3 to 6 months. But if those who can afford it do it, and if the government has a backlog of freeze-dried food, which lasts up to 25 years, we can probably survive something like this. If we don't do that, there will be thousands of fatalities.
Thousands of fatalities, ladies and gentlemen. Here you have a member, as I said, of the Council on Foreign Relations, Ted Koppel, about as establishment as they come, telling you that you need to have at least 3 to 6 months of food on hand to prepare for what may be coming. Now, is Ted Koppel a conspiracy nut job when he says it? Is he one of those crazy prepper kooks? Well, apparently he is now. And then we have the Business Insider talking about how the White House has a plan in case a solar storm wipes out our technology, but what is their plan? I don't see really any plan other than they're talking about it. And in the meantime, we're hearing reports about the possibility that there could be a CME strike within the next 10 years.
The government is enlisting 13 different departments for research and development in the event of a solar storm that could wipe out the use of modern technology. Experts constantly monitor space weather. High activity from our sun generates powerful solar flares, which are intense bursts of radiation, and can disrupt GPS and communication signals if they reach Earth. But the biggest threats are coronal mass ejections. CMEs are huge eruptions that send out bursts of solar plasma into space at unfathomable amounts of speed. CMEs that hit Earth could spark geomagnetic storms, wiping out power grids and leaving us in the dark. In March 1989, a CME caused a blackout in Quebec. Over 6 million people were without power for 9 hours. But the worst CME that ever occurred was in 1859. Known as the Carrington event, it was 3 times more powerful than what struck Quebec. It started fires and shortened out telegraph wires in the U.S. and Europe. NASA revealed that the Earth narrowly avoided a Carrington-level CME in 2012. Experts say if it would have struck us, it would have cost over $2 trillion in damages. NASA says there's a 12% chance that the Earth will get struck with an extreme solar storm within the next 10 years.
I think we have John back. John, go ahead. Oops, let me.
I feel like I'm sitting in the planetarium at the, you know, watching a program on the ceiling, okay? Mm-hmm. A bunch of ooey. Now, and if I sound angry, it's because part of me is Ted Koppel is telling people, and who's he talking to, Darren? He said he understands that there are those who can't put food on from week to week. So he's talking to the elite. He's saying, we can live through this, folks, if you take some of the money and buy some food. Is it a coronal mass ejection or CME or a power grid failure, or is it something that they're silent because they're planning it? They know what they're doing. I'm convinced they know what they're doing. And if the grid goes down, it's not going to be something that happened in outer space. It's going to be all of this programming that you've been listening to. And they're going to shut it off, or they're going to fry some line somewhere, and they're going to say, see, we told you this was happening, and you didn't prepare. There's probably only been one real corona mass ejection in all of history, and it was the one that burned up the telegraph line.
Well, you know,
I don't know.
This is not a new issue. We've been talking about this in the truth media for many, many years. My question is, why is the media all of a sudden discovered the topic? And the only other thing that I can understand, that I can figure, is they're using this potential crisis as an excuse to dump a lot of money into hardening the electric grid because the smart grid isn't coming along fast enough. That's the only thing I can figure.
Well, and we, you know, we said it for a long time, many years, at least 15 that I'm aware of, that these transformers take forever to get, but they're not ordering any. If one went down, it'd take 2 months to replace one.
Right.
They're not really worried about it. And it could cost $2 trillion. Well, Darren, what in the world difference does a couple lousy trillion dollars make? They're already $17 trillion that they admit to, and, you know, a quintillion or two quintillion.
I think it's $18
trillion now. Well, regardless, it's only a couple of trillion.
Yeah, what's a couple of trillion among friends?
Yeah, what's a couple trillion? Print them off, man. No, digitize them. Put them into existence. It hasn't stopped you in the past. What are you crying about, folks? In the, you know, in the government? Where's the big deal? I'm listening to this. Good couple. The guy that's given you BS for 40 years has written a book. He's going to sell some books. And the people that are, you know, the freeze-dried food that the military is not using, because I've seen, Darren, over in Iraq, pictures, they're eating steak. You know, they've got a big old grill, and they're eating steak. And we're flying $7 bottles of Coca-Cola in. Mm. And I'm not anti-military, and I know the guys over there, so many of them, are really doing it with the right mindset. It's just that they're ill-informed.
Yep.
So they got a bunch of freeze-dried food and K-rations that no one's using. Hey, we'll sell them to the people that we're going to destroy anyway. Let them pay, $5,000 for a six-month supply of 1953 food in a box. I mean, seriously. And feel good because they got a stale piece of pineapple in it. Oh, I got my fruit. And we're going to sell it. We'll put it in a five-gallon box. And we'll sell it to them. Anyway.
Yeah.
It outrages me.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Everything is a false reality today. You know, and speaking of false realities, John, recently, you know, these Sandy Hook victims, they're
right.
Dividing the spoils of that whole thing. The quote-unquote victims are now going to get divided amongst themselves. $1.5 million from the estate of Adam Lanza's mother.
16 of the families of the Sandy Hook shooting victims will share a $1.5 million settlement. The decision comes more than 3 years after 20 first graders and 6 teachers died in the attack. The money is coming from the estate of the gunman's mother, Nancy Lanza, who also died in the shooting. Several lawsuits say she did not properly store her gun, which her son used in the 2012 massacre at the Connecticut Elementary School. Some of the victims' families are also suing the maker of the Bushmaster gun.
Well, there you go. The payoff continues.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Well, she was, at least she wasn't, you know, some useless eater. She had $1.5 million in assets. Something else that I thought people might find interesting, and I was listening to Chris Hinckley's program, I think,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about the Paris attacks. And according to reports, the so-called Muslim gunmen stormed into the place where the death metal band was playing, yelling, "Where are the Yanks?" So let me ask you, Darren, when is the last time you heard any Arab, any Afghan, any Iraqi, anyone out of the Middle East call me or you a Yank?
That's interesting.
Who calls people Yanks, Darren? British. call people Yanks. So was this MI6 or British Special Forces or some kind of James Bond garbage?
Yeah, I don't know.
Where are the Yanks?
Could be code.
Where are the Yanks?
I wonder who did you say heard that?
I think if you get a hold of Chris Hinckley, he can tell you.
Hmm.
I know he's had rebroadcast for a couple of days, but
yeah.
I think it was Chris's broadcast that I heard it on. But man, we're living, literally, we're in the rabbit hole, Alice.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Hinckley.
I
think a lot of him. I think he does a good job. So
I do as well. All right. Well, I'm going to get back at it. Maybe someone else will call in and give a little more information. I hate to hog it.
You're not hogging right, anything.
Brother.
Thanks. Appreciate your call, man.
Take care.
Yep, you too. All right. Moving along here, folks. Earlier we were talking about sustainable development. Now they're continuing to push the idea of micro apartments.
There's a new trend in Portland housing that just might make your jaw drop.
An apartment building that opened a few months ago now holds a record in our city for the smallest apartments. The building is called Footprint Northwest on Thurman and 23rd Avenue. And just imagine for a second what 150 square feet of living space would feel like. Kind of like a storage area with a view. KGW's Nina Melhoff is here tonight to show us. Nina.
Yeah, it is not very big, you guys. I can tell you that. In fact, most comparable dorm rooms at U of L and Oregon State are bigger than the 54 units in this building. But really, it's a lifestyle that a certain group is choosing more and more. In the new world of micro apartments,
this is what 172 square feet looks like.
Everything must serve dual purpose. Your bed is your couch. Your bathroom is your shoe rack. And your fridge, well, it's tiny.
You just adjust to the size. Mm-hmm. You really do. You start shopping every few days versus a few weeks at a time.
Charissa Berry is one of 54 young, single people living in their own small space.
Okay, let me just pause that. Let's put this in the context of Ted Koppel's urging you to store freeze-dried food for 3 to 6 months. How are you going to do that in one of these apartments, huh?
Print Northwest that opened in April. Starting at 150 square feet up to 220, they are now the smallest apartments in Portland. Rent starts at $810 a month and includes all furniture.
$810 a month for a closet.
Utilities, wireless internet, and large shared kitchens on each floor.
That's small, but it's a great area, utilities included. I think it's good.
For 150 square feet, yeah, that should be $150. It's a buck a square foot, yes. Or at least $300.
Portland now has the second smallest apartments around the country. Seattle takes the cake at number one when this same company just built units only 90 square feet.
This is a different lifestyle, and this is where people want to be. They don't want to...
Oh, yeah, people want to live in a closet.
Stuff. They want to live in cool areas and be out and about and just have a place to come back to.
Sakamoto's company says it's expanding thoughtfully. This concept won't work just anywhere. On Thurman, it's close to restaurants, New Seasons Market, and lots of public transportation because most tenants don't have cars. It is not for everyone, but to live in a hot spot of town, it could be an option.
You have to really kind of weigh the pro and con, like how much you're cooking and how much you're actually saving.
Footprint Portland is under construction on a second micro apartment building in the Hollywood District. 150 square feet is about the city allowed minimum for rents. And the city's zoning defines units by kitchens instead of bedrooms. So by clustering 8 apartments around one common kitchen, the developers can cram more units in each apartment building. Back to you.
Well, the price is reasonable, eye-catching. Thank you, Nina.
$810 a month is reasonable for a closet? Wow. Anyway, MarketWatch.com. Americans are living right on the edge, ladies and gentlemen, at least when it comes to financial planning. Approximately 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account, and 21% don't even have a savings account, according to a new survey of more than 5,000 adults conducted this month by Google Consumer Survey for personal finance website GoBankingRates.com. Quote, it's worrisome that such a large percentage of Americans have so little set aside in a savings account, unquote, says Cameron Huddleston, a personal finance analyst for the site. He continued by saying they likely don't have cash reserves to cover an emergency and will have to rely on credit, friends, and family, or even their retirement accounts to cover unexpected expenses. This is supported by a survey of 1,000 adults carried out earlier this year by personal finance site Bankrate.com, which also found that 62% of Americans have no emergency savings for things such as a $1,000 emergency room visit or a $500 car repair. Faced with an emergency, they say they would raise the money by reducing spending elsewhere, 26% said that, borrowing from family or friends, 16%, or using credit cards, 12%. Among those who had savings prior to 2008, 57% said they prior to 2008 they'd use some or all of their savings in the what they call the Great Recession, according to a U.S. Federal Reserve survey. And there is the problem: the Federal Reserve. But their survey of over 4,000 adults released last year said that. This is why people are. Increasingly, there's markets for box apartments, and I do mean a box, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we gotta go. Happy New Year to all. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Somebody's gotta do it. The media isn't doing the job. We hope you'll spread the word about the broadcast and come back here again next week. I don't know what we'll have planned, but we'll be back. As we've got the holidays behind us now. Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. God bless each and every one of you. By the way, for those of you who are listening on our Govern America radio stream, after the broadcast today, we're going to be featuring a presentation by Anastasia Lynn. Anastasia, she is a native Chinese person now living in Canada. She's the reigning Miss World Canada. She's crowned Miss World Canada. She's an aspiring actress, but she's also a very outspoken critic of the communist Chinese government. Recently, she was barred from re-entering her native China to compete in a competition. She's got a lot of very important things to say about China's human rights record. So we're going to be featuring her presentation in its entirety on the stream in just a moment. For those listening live on our Govern America stream. God bless you, folks. Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. Join us again next week, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.